Good morning. Good morning. So glad that I can share another message with you all this morning. It's been a while. Such a blessing to be able to share. So today we are going to continue our series that we've been doing called Character Traits. And we've been looking at the lives of several prominent people in the Old Testament. We've been hearing their stories and learning about their character. And I'm going to jump right into it just because this is a great message and there's a lot going on. So we're going to jump right into it. But I really like this series. And I think one of the most important things that we've been learning through this series is what kind of character is it that God is calling us to have? You know, we're looking at these stories and, you know, we're seeing these other people, but how are we to live in a way that is pleasing to Him? You know, how can we follow Jesus more closely by learning about Scripture? What can we learn from these godly men and women from the Bible and thousands of years ago? And I've noticed, you know, so far that the people we've been talking about in the Old Testament, you know, they've had some really big decisions to make as God was guiding them. And one of the main things I think that we can learn from all this is how we are called to face difficult things sometimes, and then how do we respond to that in a godly way. And I think we all know in life that there are clearly difficulties and challenges and things that come up. But with these Old Testament stories, they help us remember that it's not always about the circumstance that we face. It's more about how we answer that call. You know, who do you put your trust in when things go sideways? How do you react when not everything goes your way? And it's funny because these are things that we even try to teach our kids or our grandkids, because we see them struggle, you know, with difficult things at an early age, and we know what it's like having gone through more life than them. And it's our job to teach them this simple truth that not everything in life is going to go how you want it to. Some things will be in your control, but there's clearly so many things that are going to be outside your control. I remember even my parents teaching me this as a kid. When I was, you know, sad or upset about something that didn't go my way at the time. And I think at the time I didn't even fully understand what they were talking about. I didn't understand why there was such a big emphasis on, you know, why things don't go how you want them to, how to respond to that. But later as an adult, I figured out that much of life is kind of how we respond to those things. It's an important lesson, and even an important biblical lesson, as it turns out. It kind of reminds me of a famous quote from a movie, greatest movie ever made, which is Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. That is by far my favorite. And the first movie, they talk about, you know, how Frodo is tasked with saving the world by carrying this very powerful ring across the world to destroy it. And it's a possible task. But he comes to this crossroads in this movie where, you know, he's trying to decide if he wants to give up or he really wants to carry on with this impossible task by himself. And it's kind of like the turning point in this series. So everything's kind of falling apart around him, and he knows it. And there's this point in this movie that's so great. There's like tears streaming down his cheeks, and he says, "I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had ever happened." Like, he's just saying, "I wish none of this would have gone this way. This is terrible." But then right after that, when it feels like all hope is lost, his mentor, Gandalf, he hears his voice in his head replying to him, and he says, "So do all who live to see such times, but it's not for them to decide. All you have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to you." And I think that is so great, because on this side of eternity, life is going to throw some crazy things at you. But it's simply our job to make the right decision when the time comes. And we can't control outside factors that happen to us that are out of our control. But what we can do is choose to respond to adversity in a godly way. And that's what we're going to be looking at today. And that's what matters, because it's a true test of character. How we respond to adversity is a true test of character. And the reason I bring that up is because the Old Testament character that we're looking at today is Joseph from the book of Genesis. And we're going to see today that it's that kind of principle and that kind of attitude that really his whole life is about. And if you know his story, he's dealt a really tough hand. At the beginning, he is given something that is very difficult to deal with, and he has to rely on God to find a way out of this mess that he has dealt. So, before we start, a little bit of background on Joseph. He is actually the second youngest of 12 sons to his father Jacob, and this makes Joseph the grandson to Isaac and the great-grandson to Abraham. So he comes from really one of, if not the most important family in the Old Testament. They lived in the land of Canaan, and now Canaan is a very important land that eventually will be named after Joseph's father Jacob, who's also called Israel. So that background info kind of helps us to know that this is not just a random guy in a random place, but this is a man of God's first family who is in God's holy land years later. So every story has a beginning, so we'll start at the beginning, and that is Genesis 37, 2 through 11. It says, "This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him at an old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while all your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of this dream that he had and what he said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told it his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So you may be familiar with Joseph's story, but every time I read this, I always try to put myself in his shoes. What would I do if I were him, knowing that my brothers didn't like me and they were jealous of me simply for telling them the truth? Now, there is no record of response from Joseph here, and that leads me to believe that he knew better than to talk back to his father and his older brothers, even if they hated him all the more. And he probably knew that his brothers' hearts were hard, and a rebuttal was going to be no use at the time. And as it turns out, his brothers' hate for him actually went very, very deep. And this is how. One day, his brothers were out tending sheep in the fields, and Jacob tells Joseph, "Hey, go check on your brothers, that they're far away with the flocks." And finally, Joseph tracks them down, and before he gets to where they are, they see him before he sees them, and they say, "Here comes Joseph," and they come up with this plan, and they say, "Let's kill him. Let's get rid of his body by throwing it in one of these cisterns here. We're just going to say that an animal killed him." Now, side note, this is crazy that it came to this point, that murdering their own brother was the thought of some of Jacob's sons, the same sons who would be the 12 tribes of Israel, that something this despicable and this evil would come across, you know, the minds of the future leaders of God's people. But it kind of reminds me of Cain and Abel, that, you know, from the beginning there's sin and there's murder. And it just proves that, you know, sin has never really known a bound until Jesus came. But back to the story. So they say, let's kill him. Let's hide the evidence, and we're going to tell Father that an animal ate him. You know, we're going to teach that guy who thinks he's better than us. But thankfully, the oldest brother, Reuben, steps in, he takes charge, and he tries to stop the whole thing before it even happens. Genesis 37, 21 and 22, it says, "When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him in the cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So in ancient Jewish culture, the oldest and firstborn son meant a lot. It meant that you are the natural leader, that you are in charge, you would take the place of honor when the father passes. So usually you would think that this would be the end of the matter, but not in this case. Reuben was completely outnumbered. The rest of the brothers were not fond of this idea at all. So instead, as soon as Joseph arrives, they go ahead, they rip off that colorful prize robe, and they decide to sell Joseph to some oncoming Ishmaelites who were passing on their way to Egypt to sell some goods. Now, apparently, Reuben wasn't around at the time when they sold Joseph because he was not happy when he found out what happened. But unfazed, the brothers said, let's just take the robe, we're going to dip it in goat's blood, and we're going to give it back to Father and say that he's been eaten by a wild animal. And that's what they did. And when they showed their father the bloody robe, Jacob was completely inconsolable. And this is horrible. How could these men do this to their own brother? To see their father so upset for days or weeks or months, you know, to have to sit with this lie and see him in agony probably made them sick to their stomachs, but it was too late. Joseph was now gone, and he's gone for good. Well, now what? Well, we don't know much about what happened to the brothers at this time, other than we know Judah left for some time to start a family. But we do know a lot about what happened to Joseph, and we have a lot of detail about that. So as we look at Joseph's life this morning, we're going to notice how he will continue to have to navigate through adversity as he is on this journey. And we're going to take a look at four ways that Joseph navigates adversity that we can learn from. And the first one is this. Realize that God is with you when you feel alone. Now, Joseph was clearly very alone at this time. He was sold from the Ishmaelites to now an Egyptian officer named Potiphar. And Potiphar was a very high-ranking official in Egypt at that time. Potiphar saw that Joseph was different, that he had like the spirit of God in him, which I'm assuming is probably the first time that he had ever seen anyone like that before. So he put Joseph in charge of his house, which was basically in charge of everything that he owned. But Joseph is now in a foreign land. He has no family, no friends, serving a strange person as a housekeeper, which is strange because he's like a shepherd, so this is all very new. I can imagine he probably really missed home. At least he really missed his father. But he knew deep down, despite the tragedy and things that were going on in his life, that God was with him. Genesis 29:2 says, "The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master." Sometimes in a difficult situation, you just need to stop and realize you're actually not alone and that God is with you wherever you go. The book of Joshua, that is not yet written in Joseph's time, but there is an important verse in there in Joshua. And I think Joseph still understood this important concept. In Joshua 1:9 it says, "This is my command, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." And I'm assuming that is just the principle that was in his head this whole time. It's such an amazing verse to remember and hold on to, especially when you're in a new place or you're feeling alone or you feel like you have no friends or everyone is against you. That's such an important verse as a believer. But despite what we think, and what we know about Joseph, you know, there is no record of him feeling sorry for himself in any of this. Things are going fine for him as a housekeeper, and he's, I guess, you know, doing what he needs to do. But then things get bad. Then Potiphar's wife gets involved. And she turns out she really likes Joseph, and she tries to get him to sin against his master behind closed doors with her. Joseph wisely refused, and he even went as far as to give her an explanation as to why this would be very wrong. He did not want to disobey his master, and even worse, he did not want to sin against his God. But this clearly was not good enough for Potiphar's wife. She had no knowledge of God, and she continued to ask Joseph to sin, but he continued to refuse. And that brings us to the next way that we can navigate adversity, and that is, don't let sin run your life, run from it. And that'll make more sense in a minute. So this back and forth goes on with Potiphar's wife and Joseph for a while until she finally makes a final attempt at him. This is what it says in Genesis 39:11-12. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Now this is a situation where Joseph literally was running from sin. He was living out Paul's words that would be written thousands of years later in 1 Corinthians 6:18. It says, "Run from sexual sin. No other sin so clearly affects the body as this one does. For sexual immorality is a sin against your own body." So Joseph knew this. And this is another great lesson that we learned from him. You know, even though he was in a vulnerable place, living in a foreign land, all by himself, no family, he didn't let sin creep in and ruin him. You know, he didn't let this run his life, and instead he ran from it. And it's clear he was not interested in getting in trouble. So he does the right thing here, but unfortunately, as we have pointed out before, not everything is always in our control, even when we make the right decisions. Other sin can still affect us, and that's what it does for Joseph. Because Potiphar's wife, she now realized that this was her last chance to get him to slip up, and now she is fed up with him. You know, she's angry, she's frustrated, and now she decides to frame Joseph and get him kicked out of the house. So when Potiphar comes home, she tells him the lie that was actually Joseph who tried to take advantage of her rather than the truth. Potiphar, of course, believes his wife over the slave and has Joseph thrown in jail. Ouch. Now things have gone from bad to worse. Now Joseph could have easily been put to death, but now he is in jail for who knows how long, maybe life. But this is far from the end of the story. At this point, it would have been easy for Joseph to think about giving up, like Frodo was considering with tears rolling down his cheeks. You know, he could have thought, you know, my brothers wanted to kill me. He sold me to these, you know, strange people in a foreign land. I try to be a good worker for my master, but even that is ruined by someone who tries to frame me and does so. You know, I keep doing the right thing, but I keep getting punished for it. God, where are you in all of this? He could have thought that, but it doesn't say anything about that. Now, it's in jail where things actually start turning around for Joseph. First, the Lord shows him favor in prison to the point where he, you know, had a respectable name. He was in charge of some things, even as a prisoner. Then, a couple years later, he gets an opportunity to show his worth. Two fellow prisoners, a former cupbearer and a baker, they both have these dreams that need to be interpreted. And Joseph, knowing how to interpret dreams correctly, listens to them and interprets them, the dreams for them, but they are of two different fates. Now, the cupbearer had the better fate. He was set free to once again serve in the royal court for Pharaoh. But the baker's fate was not nearly as good. But regardless, Joseph was spot on with these interpretations. Now, he had hoped by helping this cupbearer that this cupbearer was going to later, you know, help get Joseph out of prison, but he didn't. He forgot Joseph. No one came to help him. So Joseph is still stuck in prison, and it seems like no matter what Joseph does, no matter how much good, he continually is stuck where he's at. Until one day, something really, really big happened. Something that would change the entire course of history. And that is when the Pharaoh the ruler of all of Egypt and probably much of the known world, had a very important dream. And this is what it says in Genesis 41, 1 through 7. It says, when two full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river came up seven cows, sleek and fat. They had grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the seven sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep again, had a second dream. Seven heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, seven other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain were swallowed up by the seven healthy, full heads. Then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. So Pharaoh knew that when he had these dreams and he woke up, that these were very, very important dreams. And so much so that he knew they needed to be interpreted. So he called for all of his wise men or magicians or whoever was in his court to interpret these dreams, but nobody could. So finally, the cupbearer, hearing about this, remembered that there was this Hebrew man in jail a couple years ago who interpreted his own dream correctly. And the cupbearer approached Pharaoh and told him this in Genesis 41, 12, and 13. He said, now a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dream. And things turned out exactly as he interpreted them to us. I was restored to my position, and the other man was impaled. Well, that was kind of matter of fact, but the cupbearer really wanted to tell Pharaoh the truth, albeit pretty unfortunate for what happened to the other guy, which was the poor baker. Kind of makes you wonder what he did to deserve that, but I guess that is beside the point. So eventually, they get Joseph, they go get him from jail, he comes out and talks to Pharaoh, and he asks him if he can really interpret dreams. Can you do this? And Joseph tells him, I cannot. I cannot do this. It is actually God. It's actually God who interprets the dreams. And I think this is such an admirable and truthful answer from Joseph. And that brings us to our third way to help us navigate adversity. And that is to always give God the credit for anything good. Joseph's gift to interpret dreams was actually a gift from God. So God deserved the credit. And this is what it says in James 1:17. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. So Joseph could have easily said, yep, it's all me. I interpret dreams. I do it by myself. And he could have made himself sound more profound and really kind of pumped himself up to sound better than he was. But he did not. Because he wanted, even though he wanted to get out of jail, he still gave God all the praise and all the credit, because he knew that telling the truth was going to be the thing that set him free. And it did. It turned out that answer that he gave to Pharaoh, apparently it was good enough. And Pharaoh said, all right, okay, go. You're allowed to interpret my dreams. So Joseph hears them, and upon hearing them, he knows exactly what they are. God gives him the answer. He tells him that these two dreams that you had, they actually mean the same thing. This is a warning from God that there's going to be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of a terrible, terrible famine. Now Pharaoh, he takes the interpretation as truth, and he says, that sounds right to me. And he now understands that Joseph is different, that he is wise, and he has God's spirit, even though he doesn't know who God is. He knows there's something different about him. So he puts full trust in him, and he puts him in charge of all the preparations for all the food storage. He even goes as far to making him second in command in all of Egypt under himself. Now, this is quite a turnaround from Joseph just being a prisoner for life, maybe just a few moments ago. Well, after the 7 years of plenty and they're storing up grain, then the famine begins. and this famine is severe. There are so many that are affected by it. This actually includes Joseph's homeland of Canaan, where his father and all of his brothers still live. Now, Jacob and his sons, they are clearly in need of food, and everyone else does during this famine. So the family decides, okay, somehow they got word that there is food in Egypt, and they need to make the journey to go get food. So they send 10 brothers out to go get food, except for their youngest brother, Benjamin, who is actually Joseph's only full brother. That's important for later. So upon arrival to Egypt, Joseph is, you know, he's doing his duty, and then he sees his brothers come in. Now, he recognized them, but they, of course, did not recognize him at all. And they did it for a few reasons, and here's why. It had been now 21 years since he last saw them. He was in a very unexpected position of authority, and this is the most important one. He was speaking to them through an interpreter. So the brothers were clueless. They probably thought Joseph is probably dead, or he is in a faraway land. We'll never see him again. So now Joseph, seeing his brothers, he has this decision to make about his own identity. You know, through his dreams, he knew that these were now fulfilled with the sheaves and the stars. He knew that this was fulfilled. So he could have revealed himself, but he decides not to. And I think it's interesting, the Bible doesn't really necessarily give a direct reason for why Joseph does not reveal himself right away and decides to kind of drag this out. But that's what he did. Now, my best guess is that he wanted to put his brothers through a series of tests. And he wants to test their character to see if they had changed from the last time he saw them, where they almost killed him and they sold him, and see what they were like now. So the brothers walk in, and Joseph gives them the first of these tests. He accuses them of being spies from a foreign land. And he tells them that he thinks they're just there to Egypt to scope out the land, to find a way to attack it. And now these brothers they're so confused. They don't know why he would say that. Genesis 42, 10 and 11, they say, "No, my Lord," they answered, "your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." They're pleading their case to him. You know, they're like, what are you getting at? Why would you think that? And they told Joseph that, you know, we have our father back home. We have our youngest brother back home. We're just here like everyone else trying to get food. And Joseph tells them, "Well, I'm not sure I believe you. Go, if you have a youngest brother, go get him. And let me see if you're telling the truth. And then I'm going to actually keep one of you here as insurance, so I know that you're going to actually come back with that youngest brother." So for whatever reason, the absurdity of this situation, it reminded the oldest brother, Reuben, of their actions years ago with Joseph. And the brothers agreed, and they thought, okay, now we are being punished. This is what it says in Genesis 42, 22 to 24. Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then came back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. So Joseph is listening to them, and it seems that now he is completely overcome with emotion, and it's possible that, you know, he's wanting to get all the brothers there, just to get everyone there, maybe even his father, then maybe do a big reveal. But regardless, he has the second brother, Simeon, tied up, and Joseph sends the rest of them back to their homeland of Canaan to get their youngest brother. And he knows they still need grain for their family, so, you know, he gives them what they need, but not without a twist. He has his servants put their money back into their bags. He has them sneak it in. The money that they were using to pay for the grain, it's snuck back in with them as they're leaving. So now the brothers get halfway home, and they check their bags, and they say, why is our silver back in here? What is happening? What is going on? We did not ask for free grain. We tried to pay for it. And they're confused, and now they even say, well, you know, what is God doing to us? And they are unaware that Joseph is still kind of testing them. So the brothers finally get home, and now they need to tell their father Jacob about everything about what is going on. And they say, where's Benjamin? We need to take him with us. We got to go back to Egypt because of this, this, and this. And Jacob sees that their money is back, and now he's getting suspicious of what is going on. And he tells them, you can't take Benjamin with you. I've already lost Joseph. I'm not going to lose him as well. But then the brothers tell him, well, we have to go get Simeon because he is left there. And now it's just, they have like this big mess on their hands, this huge dilemma. Now finally, Judah speaks up to his father and he says, all right, let me personally take Benjamin. I will guard him with my life. If something happens to him, I will take full responsibility. And Jacob finally agrees and realizes, hey, this has to be done for the family to survive. So the brothers go back to Egypt, this time with Benjamin. And when Joseph sees their back, he tells his servants to prepare a feast for these men. And the brothers are confused, and they're wondering, you know, are we in trouble? We got our grain back. We got our silver back. You know, they're thinking, what is he going to do to us now? So they tell him, well, we don't know what's going on here. We're trying to give you back our silver from last time. And, you know, Joseph tells them, no, everything is okay, and he brings out Simeon, and they're reunited. And so they have this feast, and, you know, he sees Benjamin, and Benjamin is his only full brother. Their mother is Rachel, and so he really wanted to see his only full brother. And so, again, Joseph is just so overcome with emotion. He has to even go to another room to weep. Now, after the meal, it seems like everything is okay. You know, they're now on good terms. They have, you know, what they need. Joseph gives them grain. He gives them silver, as much as they could carry. Everything is fine. Sounds like this is the end for the brothers. But then Joseph had one more test, because it was not over. Before the brothers left to go back to their father, Joseph had his servants slip an important silver cup in Benjamin's bag so that nobody saw it. So Joseph let them leave to go home, but shortly after they left, he said to his men, hey, go catch up to the brothers, search their things. And so they did. And the brothers are stopped by these men. They're very confused. And, you know, they say, we would never do that. We even were truthful people. We brought back the extra silver. And they were so confused of what's happening. And Joseph's officials say, okay, well, we'll see. They lined up each brother, looked through all of their bags, and finally they get to the youngest of Benjamin, and of course, they see the silver cup is in there. And all these brothers cannot believe it. They tore their clothes in disgust. They knew their penalty was going to be severe for stealing, and they now had to load all of their stuff back up and go back to Egypt, expecting the worst. Now they get there, and they lay down at Joseph's feet. And Joseph is kind of playing it up with them a little, and he's like, what have you done? Don't you know I can find out if someone's stealing from me? And the fourth oldest brother, Judah, says, he's begging and pleading. He's saying we're innocent. But he also understands there are consequences for this. And Joseph says, all right, well, forget it. You know, it was in the youngest. He seems to be the one that's at fault, so he stays, and the rest of you guys can go home. And then Judah realized, oh no, this is not good. That's the one guy that I promised my father on my own life that I would bring him back. If I do not, my father will die in misery for another lost son. So Judah then has a word with Joseph and explains to him that Benjamin cannot stay for this reason. So after a full explanation, Judah offers to stay and be the slave in Benjamin's place. Now this is a very admirable and selfless act. And this was clearly noted by Joseph, who at this point could no longer control his emotion knowing that one brother was going to give up his life for another brother. So he wept loudly, and then at this point, finally decided to reveal himself to all his brothers. He now wanted to tell them in joy that God had his hand in this whole thing. And this is what it says in Genesis 45, 4 through 8. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Now come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there had been famine in the land, and the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all of Egypt." It says after this reveal that the brothers didn't quite share the same joy at first. They were a little terrified. You know, they thought, "Oh no, this is the guy that we betrayed all these years ago. Now he's one of the most powerful men in the world. Maybe he wants us killed. Maybe he wants us in jail." But Joseph instead is filled with joy and explains, you know what? This was all for a reason. This was God's plan, as crazy as it seemed. And then from there, I think the brothers finally realized we're not going to be harmed, and they could celebrate with Joseph. It says Joseph wept over them. He embraced them. You know, he talked with them, and all was forgiven. All that had happened years ago was now forgiven. And I love this picture because it kind of captures some of that we see from the story. Now, obviously, it was a sinful choice made by the brothers so many years ago to sell Joseph. But regardless, God worked it out to not only save his family, but to save the future of God's family. And this included the most important part of this family was going to be thousands of years later with the birth of Jesus. Now, Joseph then says to his brothers, "Go get your father." And upon Jacob's arrival, Joseph explains to his father and his brothers that they are now saved from the famine. Not only that, but even the Pharaoh says the whole family will now be wealthy. They will have all the best that Egypt has to offer. The best land will be set aside for them and for their families for generations and generations. And with that, it was evident that Joseph forgave his brothers. And he could have easily thrown them in jail. He could have made them slaves. He could have had them killed. But none of that even crossed his mind. He wanted to know what kind of men that they turned out to be after such a terrible decision years ago. But in the end, he had forgiven them for what they had done. And this brings us to the last and the most important step, I think, of navigating adversity, and that is to repay betrayal with forgiveness. And I understand that forgiveness is not always an easy thing. And repaying betrayal with forgiveness is even more difficult. And I'm assuming, you know, maybe it wasn't as easy for Joseph either. But once he forgave them, I bet it was a big weight lifted off his shoulders. The brothers could have never guessed that this evil act so many years ago was going to play such an important part in saving their family for generations. But that is how God works. So at the end of the story, Joseph says this important verse to help them understand and to make sense of everything. It says in Genesis 50, 20, and 21, Joseph tells them, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." and he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. And I think with this story, there are so many takeaways, which many of them definitely include how to navigate life when it's unfair to you. But at the heart of it, I think the main lesson is that you cannot overstate the power of forgiveness. Because despite their sins against him, Joseph forgave his brothers. And it's a great reminder that despite our sins, Jesus forgives us every time we come to him in repentance. And I think that's so important because we know that we are forgiven. And we are reminded, when we read stories like this, we are reminded to forgive others when they sin against us. You know, and that's just like Jesus tells us in the Lord's Prayer. And in this story, we see that this act of forgiveness is really kind of at the core of what it means to be a Christ follower, to forgive. And one thing that I didn't get a chance to talk about is that there are so many parallels between Joseph and Jesus' story. But I think one of the main ones is that Joseph is the blameless favorite son of the father. He suffered at the hands of evil brothers and ended up saving much of the known world. In a similar way, we have Jesus, the blameless son of God. He suffered, died at the hands of evil men, and he saved the entire world of their sins. And I think at the heart of both of those stories, we see forgiveness. And we see that betrayal is repaid with forgiveness. And I think that's so important. And in Genesis 50:20, I'll read this one more time. It says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Let's pray. God, we just thank you so much for who you are, for your love. And God, that you made a way for us for eternal salvation. God, that you have the power to forgive, and you do so freely and abundantly. God, we just thank you so much for how you help us to navigate through life, to hold on to your word, so that we know which way to turn and to not give in to sinful ways. God, we know that you take what the enemy meant for evil, and you turn it for good. Because, God, your ways are higher, and your ways are above all. God, we ask you just to help us to walk in your truth with you, and to remember to love, and to remember to forgive. And we ask all of this in Jesus' name. Amen. I really, really enjoy that song because I love how well the lyrics fit into what we were just talking about when you apply it to Joseph's life and realize that he had God as his firm foundation when everything around him was crumbling and everything was falling apart. He knew that God was with him and God was never going to leave him or forsake him. And in his life, went from bad to worse, went from bad to good because he had God as his foundation, and he was affecting those around him through his life and through God's Spirit. So that's so amazing. So, all right, well, that is all for this week. Thank you so much for being here, and if we don't see you tomorrow at the prayer walk, we will see you next week.